Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, fj@offbeatoregon.com, your host for today's Offbeat Oregon History Podcast episode. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy it. Welcome back to Iconic Food Items That Were Invented in Oregon. Today we have part two of our two-part presentation of this. We had six of them. We did three yesterday. We're going to do three more today. Starting with the tater tot in 1953, and of course, by extension, those delicious breakfast hash brown patties like the ones you get with breakfasts at fast food places, which are basically long, odd-shaped tater tots. As we turn our attention to what food historian Heather Arndt Anderson calls Oregon's prodigal spud, we are straying into distinctly non-Christmassy territory. Of course, this is appearing on the podcast a long time before Christmas, but this episode was originally written at Christmas time in 2023. In the few dozen short years since brothers Golden and Neef Grigg invented the tater tot, it has become as much a part of the American comfort food landscape as the Velveeta-drenched macaroni noodle has. And it all got started after the Second World War, when Golden and Neef rented a flash freezing plant in Ontario, the town in Oregon, not the province in Canada. They were in the frozen vegetable business, specializing in sweet corn. A few years later, their landlord went bankrupt, and the brothers bought the plant out of foreclosure and expanded their sweet corn hustle into a full-blown frozen foods company, planning to add frozen French fries to their offerings as nearly the first order of business. Ontario being right on the Idaho border, the brothers, who actually lived on the Idaho side of the line, named their new company Or-Ida. By 1953, Or-Ida was the biggest producer of frozen corn in the country. But the brothers knew the real money would be in those French fries. Another famous Idaho resident, J.R. Simplot, had figured out how to freeze potatoes without them turning black. Now the brothers wanted to use his system to create frozen, ready-to-cook fries. But this was turning out to be a bigger headache than they thought it would be. The problem was, when a potato was cut up into fries, they needed a way to get rid of the irregular pieces and cut off ends. They were having a hard time coming up with a mechanical solution to this, and customers were really not into buying a bag of French fries that was full of mostly half-inch-long slivers. Then one day, a very confused salesman showed up to try to sell the brothers a prune sorting machine. Of course, everyone got a good laugh when the salesman realized his error, but then, instead of just hitting the road in search of the nearest actual fruit processor, he stuck around and visited for a bit. One thing led to another, and pretty soon the salesman was showing off his fruit sorter. And the brothers were thinking hard. The machine looked like it would, with the right modifications, do a pretty good job on potatoes as well. Sorting the potatoes by size would go a long way toward eliminating the tiny fragments problem. To his probable surprise, when the salesman left the Griggs shop, he had an order in his pocket, and with these modifications that the brothers had specified, it turned out to be just what they needed. But now they had another problem. A good problem, but a problem nonetheless. Lots and lots of ends and bits of potatoes left over from the French fry cutting process. They started out by feeding them with livestock, but the brothers hated this. There was nothing wrong with the potato bits they were getting. They were perfectly fit for human consumption. Feeding them to animals seemed like a waste of good food. So they tried a few things, ways to turn tiny bits of potato into something people would want to eat. And one of the first things they tried was chopping the potatoes up fine, compressing them into a long, thin log like a giant pepperoni stick, and cutting the stick into segments. Very quickly, they figured out that they were onto something big. The tater tots had their table debut the following year, when Golden and Neef brought a 15-pound bag of tots to the 1954 National Potato Convention. Neef persuaded the chef at the convention dinner to cook up the tots and serve a few of them on small saucers next to each diner's plate. "These were all gobbled up faster than a dead cat could wag its tail," Neef wrote, colorfully if a bit incoherently, 35 years later. Big League Chew, 1977. Baseball players back in the day were somewhat famous for chewing tobacco on the field. Fans would see them pull a pouch of Red Man or Beech Nut out of their uniform pocket and dip out a big pinch and stuff it between the cheek and gum. Sometimes it would make a visible bulge. Minor league slugger Rob Nelson probably chewed the stuff too, although he played for the Portland Mavericks in Portland. As in most of the Pacific Northwest, moist snuff products like Copenhagen and Skoal were and still are far more popular than pouch chaws like Beechnut. But maybe not. The pouch was, after all, sort of an informal baseball tradition. So in 1977, while waiting in the dugout for his turn at bat, Nelson was not surprised to see the bat boy pulling a Beechnut pouch out of his trousers and taking a big pinch out of it. He wasn't surprised, but he was probably a bit alarmed. The bat boy was not old enough to be chewing tobacco. "Oh no," the kid said when challenged on his chaw.
"It's just a tobacco pouch that I've put shredded licorice in."
This got Nelson thinking. In a world of avid baseball fans who were too young to dip or chew, might there be a market for a candy product that simulated it? He invested a little money in a bubblegum-making kit and started prototyping. Within just a few years, he had a finished product and a patent, which he sold almost immediately to a subsidiary of the Wrigley Company. In its target demographic, Big League Chew was a huge and immediate hit. I myself remember how popular and ubiquitous it was on middle school playgrounds in the early 1980s, just 3 years after Rob Nelson saw that bat boy chewing on what he thought was real tobacco. The Corn Dog, 1939. Now, this one is really interesting. On Labor Day in 1939, George Boyington, a Rockaway Beach entrepreneur who ran a hot dog stand downtown, was sitting in his kitchen glumly contemplating a huge pile of hot dog buns. The buns were too stale to sell. He'd ordered too many, and now he was going to have to throw them out. Remember, this was 1939. Plastic bread bags would not be invented for another 18 years, so throwing a bag or two in the freezer was not an option. The buns had to come in from the bakery the same day they went out wrapped around a hot dog. That meant that he had to estimate how many he thought he'd need the day before, place the order, and hope for the best. And usually he'd sell more than he thought he'd need. It was better to have a few stale buns to feed to the seagulls than to drive away customers because he'd run out of them. So he threw away a lot of buns, and it always bothered him. As he moped there, glaring at the unsaleable pile, Boyington started thinking about how awesome it would be if he could make the bun and the hot dog at the same instant, just before handing it all over to the customer. That's when it hit him. He could do that, just it wouldn't be a bun. But what he could do is dip a hot dog in batter the way you do a piece of fish for fish and chips, and deep fry it on the spot. Boyington went home and started experimenting with recipes. Soon he nailed down what he thought was the perfect blend of flavors and textures to complement a hot dog. And then he went into business, marketing Pronto Pup Batter Mix in stores nationwide. Boyington moved to Portland to set up a manufacturer of his mix and to be closer to distribution networks. Very quickly, it became clear that Boyington had invented something special. He trademarked the name Pronto Pup and launched his hot dog stand business as a franchise. Pronto Pups, the franchise stores, are still all over the country and are super popular in the Midwest. Pronto Pups, the brand of corn dog, also have become synonymous with county and state fairs over the years and are big crowd pleasers at any kind of summer outdoor event. You don't see much of them during the holiday season, of course. There is, by the way, a special Pronto Pup stand in Rockaway, the original Pronto Pup, to commemorate the town's role in the invention of the world's most iconic state fair fare. People who are fans of their corn dogs sometimes make pilgrimages, or at least make a point of stopping by on their Oregon coast vacations. Key sources in this story included The Fruit That Made Oregon Famous, an article by Inara Wertzemeeks, April 16, 2007, Portland Morning Oregonian, The Tater Tot is American Ingenuity at its Best by Kelsey McKinney, August 28, 2017, Eater Magazine. How Two Oregon Brothers' Efforts to Mitigate Food Waste Created the Tater Tot by Heather Arndt Anderson, Oregon Public Broadcasting, February 2, 2022. A Classic American Concession Was First Fried in Oregon by Megan Cuthill, Oregon Public Broadcasting, July 16, 2022. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Offbeat Oregon, by the way, is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. In addition to Offbeat Oregon books, podcasts, and audiobooks, we also publish book and audiobook versions of collections of what you might call street literature. 1920s pulp magazine writers like H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Rice Burroughs, gothic penny dreadful titles like Sweeney Todd and The Adventures of Highwayman Dick Turpin, all straight shots of bottled-in bond working man's fiction and working women's fiction from the last couple of centuries. If that sounds like your jam, I'd love to have you check them out. That is pulp-lit.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.